Good morning. May it please the Court. I am Kevin Funk with the law firm of Durrett Crump on behalf of the appellants Nancy and Andrew Welton. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
The key issue in this appeal is whether or not Raymond Santelli was sufficiently qualified to render an opinion on the interest payable on a bank account. It is our position that the trial court abused its discretion when it refused to qualify Mr. Santelli as an expert. This resulted in an egregious result, because when the jury determined that BB&T and its predecessor banks had been in possession of the Weltons' money for 35 years, the jury could award nothing other than the face amount of the certificate, plus the 6 months' worth of interest that was specified in that instrument. So that was the original $10,000, plus about, I think, $600 or $900 additional. Because what happened is after the 6 months, it converted to a regular savings account and earned interest at the rate payable thereon. Mr. Santelli was unquestionably qualified. He was a senior vice president of First Capital Bank and had 20 years of banking experience. He had a degree in finance from the University of Richmond. He had continuing education with the Virginia Banking Association School of Bank Management, where he testified he had been tasked with running a hypothetical bank. Mr. Santelli had worked as a credit analyst at a small bank.
Let me stop you there, if I might, because there's no question that he has a very impressive resume. The question is what he's being called to testify about. So what is the target of his testimony for which he is qualified?
The target of his testimony?
Mm-hmm.
That is to determine what, if I don't answer it correctly, let me know. The target is to find out what BB&T and the two predecessor banks would have paid on a savings account. We asked for that in discovery. Bank said, we can't do it, it's unduly burdensome. So what we did is we had to do it by expert witness. And so what Mr. Santelli did is he looked at national surveys of what banks were paying on savings accounts, and he had that data available to him. It was his opinion that the Fed funds rate is the primary driving factor of what a bank would pay on a savings account. Mr. Santelli had access to the Fed funds rate going back to 1979. He was able to compare that driving factor, the Fed funds rate, to the surveys of what banks were paying. And he ran month by month, and that's in the record, month by month he ran a comparison from 1979 to 2014, October of 2014, when our expert designation was given.
Let me ask you this. Did the trial court find him unqualified? In other words, not willing to qualify him as an expert? Or did the trial court say, no, he's qualified, let's hear what he's got to say, and then cut out a portion of his testimony based upon the view that it was too speculative and thus inadmissible?
The former, Your Honor. If you look at page 270 of the joint appendix, the trial court refused to qualify Mr. Santelli for two reasons. One is that he had no experience in making a historical analysis of interest rates, and then the second was because he relied on a single piece of data without understanding the correlation between that data point and savings rates. That's 270 of the joint appendix. Now,
oh, but we'll stop right there. That's a, if I might follow the last case, that's a great question that Justice Kelsey just asked. Because
they're all great questions.
They're all great questions.
Good answer.
There were two rulings that were made, as you said. One is that the court found that he was not qualified for historical analysis of interest rates. Now, the court did make a ruling on qualification. But the second thing the court said was that the testimony that he was qualified to testify about was speculative. So the second part was not a question of qualifications. It was a question of the actual content of the expert testimony. Is that correct or not?
Your Honor, I think at that page on 270, he was ruled, there was one pending motion. I had made a motion to qualify Mr. Santelli. At no point had he been voir dire on the foundation of his opinion. You will not find that anywhere in the transcript. He had been voir dire on his expertise.
Well, let me give you the testimony.
Okay.
question. Do you have any background or training in the historical analysis of interest rate trends and how interest rates are set? Mm-hmm. Other than my college education, different classes I took there, nothing since.
Which page are I, may I ask? I'm sorry, I should call
it. 265.
Okay.
Then asked a question, how about experience? Other than this case, where did a historical analysis of interest rates, in this case, where you did a historical analysis of interest rates, have you ever undertaken as a part of your job requirements any historical analysis of interest rates? Answer, no. Mm-hmm. Now, on that testimony, I think the trial court said he was not qualified to offer an opinion. Now, on the other aspects of it, I guess is a there was sort of a division of the subject matter of the questioning. The court then, it seems to me, said that the testimony was speculative because of the differences between regions, size of banks, etc. So it seems to me there's two rulings that are going on here.
Well, I think what happened, there are two bases for one ruling. And if I could direct the court to page 270 of the joint appendix, where the court said, I understand your argument. And then it said the problem is that he does not have any experience whatsoever or education in the area of making the type of historical analysis that's being called upon for him to go all the way back to 1979. And then he said, and furthermore, I believe there are serious questions just the reliance on a single piece of data without knowing the correlation between that data point and the savings rate and the reliability of the savings account rates. And he talks about his own testimony. He said he does not know what the correlation and has not studied the correlation specifically between the federal funds rate versus any other variable which he's testified to impact savings rate. And here's the key sentence. So I can't qualify him. So what...
I see what your point is, that they're both two bases for the lack of qualification.
That's right, Your Honor. And it is our position that he should not have gone into the methodology at this stage of the case, because that's not... You qualify him, and then you take up the issue that this is the way the trial court should have done it. You qualify him, and then you say... What if anybody wants to challenge the foundation outside of the view of the jury, they could have questioned Mr. Santelli about his methodologies, and then BB&T could have moved to exclude the testimony. At no time in this transcript did BB&T move to exclude the testimony, and it is our position is because the judge never qualified Mr. Santelli, and we never got to that point. At no time did I or counsel for BB&T argue about what are the standards for foundation, what would have been a proper methodology. Yes, the court went into an area that would have been proper upon a motion to exclude based on an inadequate foundation, but he did it in the context of qualifying Mr. Santelli. That's the problem, and that was improper.
You know, it actually surprises me what his answer was. He was asked, other than this case, have you ever undertaken as a part of your job requirements any historical analysis of interest rates? Answer, no. Seems to me that based on his employment, the answer should have been yes. But it was his answer. I think maybe what he heard was, have you ever testified in any other case about historical analysis of interest rates, because he used to be on a committee of the bank to establish interest rates, which has to be done with some, it's not a vacuum. What was it yesterday? What is it? What's the trend? How's it going? Business interest, etc. It seems to me that the answer to that question should have been an enormous surprise.
Well, I think what Mr. Santelli did testify of what factors they take into consideration in sitting on that interest rate setting committee. What is the competitive environment? We look at what other banks are doing. We look at the Fed funds rate. I mean, in a sense, yes, that you know, you're looking back in maybe a day, a week, maybe a month. I think what Mr. Santelli, the way he took that question was, have you ever gone back in time and tried to figure out what an interest rate would have been? I think that is a fair interpretation by Mr. Santelli of the trial court's question. Because what the trial court was trying to do is saying, have you ever done anything like this before? And Mr. Santelli hadn't. But it is our position that the trial court imposed a distinction that wasn't warranted, that setting an interest rate prospectively, and that's what BB&T said, well, Mr. Santelli only sets them prospectively. He's never looked at them historically. Mr. Santelli was, by definition, looking at what a banker in 1979 or 1982 or 1985 had done prospectively. And he had the data that he believed would have driven that decision, and that's the Fed funds rate.
How does he know what a banker would have done in 1979? Well, he wasn't a banker then.
He wasn't a banker in 1979, but he understands today what a banker would have done, and he can take that data, the data that he would rely on today, and then compare it to what bankers were actually doing in 1979. So if Mr. Santelli says, I think the Fed funds rate is the driving force behind interest rates, I've got a survey of what banks were paying in 1979 and every year since. And then he compares those two. There was a $633 correlation over a 35-year period between the data point, which was the Fed funds rate, and the surveys that banks were paying. That is a remarkably close correlation.
What banks?
He relied on a national survey of...
That's the second dilemma that the trial court had. It certainly is a correlation, but you have a baseline with these national figures. But they're always compared against, first of all, localities, and second of all, the size of the bank. Mm-hmm. National averages don't mean anything if you're trying to figure out what the interest rate was. Mm-hmm. With BB&T and its predecessor banks over that period of time.
Right.
I think that the trial judge was saying, well, that's all well and good, but the target of your testimony is not a generalized interest rate. It's a specific interest rate for banks over a specific period of time that are in a specific locality that have specific characteristics, namely size.
Yes. Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, I think Mr. Santelli's expert report, which is in the record, he actually addressed that issue, that yes, there are regional differences, there are differences between the size of banks, but he did not feel that they were material enough. He felt actually that that would push the number higher because this was held by a small bank, which has a need to generate capital and would have paid a higher interest rate. He addressed that in his designation. So, yes, there are differences, but he didn't feel they were material enough and they would have driven the number higher, and he wanted to be more conservative on it. So he felt this number came in lower if you take into account those other factors. And again, the standard for damages is not 100% certitude. It's reasonable certainty. And what happened here is you had a finding by a jury that the bank had held it for 35 years and they can collect no interest on their,
Mr. Funk,
on their money.
I know you're answering my question, but you wanted to save some time.
I guess I've got a question for you.
There it goes.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to cut anybody off.
Go ahead. I'll ask you about it when you come.
Okay, thank you.
If need be.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Perot. I'm here on behalf of BB&T, the Appellee. Your Honor, there's really three issues on appeal. Two of them on the cross appeal. One is the statute of limitations. The other is a failure to grant a motion to strike by the court. The third one is the damages issue that we've been talking about this morning. I'd like to put that in a little different context. What happened? The plaintiff's expert, Mr. Santelli, was not qualified to testify on interest rates that would have been paid by any of the financial institutions involved in this case. The court, for a period of time, that was 1979 to 2006, for the rates during 2007 to the present, the court said he was qualified because he had served on this interest rate committee, which I'll talk about later.
But how do you respond to the assertion that really, if you do an abuse of discretion standard, the real alleged lack of discretion or poor use of discretion was collapsing the admissibility factors into what should be a fairly straight up or down qualification judgment?
Well, let me put that first in perspective. The judge was talking about the latter period of time. He was talking about 2006 to the present. And he was going to qualifying for that period of time to talk about interest rates. And then we had this national survey, which was not a national survey of savings rate. It was a one-month CD rate that he found somewhere for 35 years. And so all he did was say, okay, on one-month CDs, which is not what this was. This was a money market certificate. It was a savings account. It's not even the same type of instrument. And he said, by coincidence, the federal funds rate is close to that. Previously, he testified that he didn't know how to correlate the federal funds rate or LIBOR or U.S. Treasuries. So getting off a little bit, you have to keep it in perspective that we're just talking this period of time, and that's what the judge did. So the admissibility ruling was not appealed in this case, and I believe that's the law of the case on appeal. That testimony is out of the case. I think it has consequences. I think it means if this case is remanded, that there the damage claim for that period of time is gone. It can't be retried. I think it has consequences a little bit further than that, because what the judge is saying, that national survey is too speculative, it's not proper evidence, and that would taint any... Mr. Santelli came back and tried to do the same thing for the earlier period of time, that it wouldn't be admissible. That's the consequences of what I believe happened on that ruling. I believe Mr. Santelli was not qualified because of the answers he gave to the judge. Remember, the exact words of what he should be qualified for was as an expert in the field of establishing bank interest rates on savings deposits. That's it, the appendix 242-243. So that was the motion before the court. We already discussed he didn't have any experience. He'd never been asked to do that before. The judge said, loud voir dire. The judge said, I haven't heard enough about his expertise. Do you want to ask more questions? And there was more voir dire. The voir dire by BB&T. And then the judge took over. And he started asking questions. And I think that clearly showed his lack of education and experience in establishing interest rates. So he asked, do you have any background or training in historical analysis? We've been over that before. For the short, and he said, other than my college education and what different classes I took there, nothing since. He was in college in 1994 is when he graduated. He testified that the federal funds rate were a component of interest rates. So the court asked him if there are any other ways interest rates are set, such as LIBOR and U.S. Treasuries. He said that was true. His specific answer was, if you go deep, deep down, yes. The court then asked a very critical question about his qualifications. They asked him, so have you had an opportunity to study, or have you had any education in studying the correlation between LIBOR or Treasury offerings and the overnight rate that's offered by the Federal Reserve? Have you done that on a historical basis? He rambled with his answer, but at the end he said this. But to answer your question specifically as far as correlation, no. Now, at this point, the judge is disqualifying him before he's considered anything about the national survey. He said he can't find him qualified for that period, original period of time from 1979 through 2006. But he talked about, he said, well, he was on this interest rate committee. Let me tell you what the interest rate committee is about. There are seven or eight bankers on that committee. They are brought interest rates from other bank officials, and they're discussed. So they're talking about, really, what they're talking about is what rate should their little bank charge in the marketplace. So they have rates, they have rates of other places, and they have the recommended rates that they're given in the committee. And everybody renders their opinion, and the committee makes a decision. That was his experience, and that was only for his bank, and it was only for a period, small period of time. So we have that situation where the judge said, And he went on to say, well, okay, you are, but look what you've done. All you've done is this national survey, and that's too speculative.
You said, the judge says, you are what?
You are qualified to talk about, I'm sorry, Justice, he is qualified to testify about the period of time from essentially 2007 to the present. And then he said, but here's what you're doing, and it's too speculative. And this court has said, and there was no objection to that. That ruling was not objected to. It was not assigned error on appeal. And this court said in the Lockheed, where there's no assignment of error, a cross error is taken to a part of a final judgment. The judgment becomes the law of the case and is not subject to relitigation. So we would say that, and I truly believe, if you watch what the court did, he was very careful, this voir dire, this examination of Mr. Santelli took a long time, and I think the court followed what you all directed him to do in the Hyundai versus Duncan case. He determined qualification first, and then he ruled on admissibility.
Now, on your plea and bar, you also, I think the trial court erred in not granting it. And I think your position is that the six-year statute of limitation begins running, in this case, at the time the certificate is issued.
Yes.
If that were the case, let's say for a moment the certificate was a seven-year certificate and it would become due. It's not in this case, obviously. But suppose you had a case where it was due in 7 years. Under your theory, the statute of limitations would run before the money was due.
I think if you had a seven-year certificate,
how could that be right?
Because there's another part of the statute that if it's a certificate deposit, in which I would think a seven-year certificate would be, then you look to 8.3A-118 for the statute of limitations. It becomes 6 years from the due date at a minimum. There are a couple of requirements in there. So the seven-year certificate would obviously, the statute wouldn't run until at least it's due. And I think the statute says due and demand made. Right. So you're okay. I mean, that's not an issue as long as you fall into the first subsection of the statute of limitations, which applies to certificates of deposit.
So let's change the hypothetical slightly. What if it's a five-year certificate? Do you then just have 1 year to sue?
Well, we have to know what we're talking about. Are we talking about a certificate of deposit, which is different? Which you'd have the entire 5 years if it's a certificate deposit. If we're talking about what we have here, this is nothing more than a certificate. They call it a money market certificate. It's non-renewable, so it's not a certificate of deposit. It doesn't fall within the statute for a certificate of deposit because it's not. And there's uncontroverted testimony in here from the banker that it's not treated as a certificate of deposit. And by law, because it's not renewable, it's not a certificate of deposit. So what happens is it basically becomes, after 6 months, it turns into a savings account. So what you're really talking about for the purpose of statute of limitation is a deposit account. And you have the unique facts in this case that there's no evidence that was never another a communication from the bank about this account other than the certificate itself. They didn't pay taxes. That's in the evidence. And I can give you that site. But they
what would there to pay taxes on if you weren't being paid any interest? What would there to pay any taxes on?
Well, the conclusion I come to, well, if the bank's not paying any interest,
why do they need to report on their taxes?
I have no idea. Of course, we're talking about.
But you said you seemed like it was a big deal. They didn't report it on their taxes. I'm like, what is there to report on your taxes if you're not getting interest off of this?
Well, you're earning interest. You would get a 1099 form.
But they didn't get one. The bank wasn't paying them any interest. So why would they report it on their taxes? I guess I don't know.
Well, you can come to the conclusion in this case that maybe he actually went to the bank and was paid and got his certificate paid back in 1979.
Yeah. Or maybe the bank just kept his money and never paid him any interest. That's the other option, and that's what the jury found. I mean, so I don't see it would move the ball forward at all. But go ahead. I mean,
when you say it becomes a savings account, you're using that in a figurative sense, not a legal sense. Is that correct?
Now, the description by the banker was, this is a money market certificate. It's non-renewable by its terms on the face of it. and that after 6 months, it becomes a savings account at a normal rate. And if you want to redeem it, you don't need to present the certificate. You go to the bank and say...
Well, I'm interested in what is the legal authority for that? I mean, because I don't think it helps you. But tell me, what's the legal authority?
For this...
That it becomes a savings account.
It's the terms of the certificate itself.
So the terms of the instrument?
Yes, and I'm not...
Right, well, if that's the case, why aren't we talking about a statute of limitations for a savings account?
Well, I think we are. I mean, as I read the...
if I have a savings account and I want to put money in it, I want to take money out of it, you know, I do it for a long period of time. Are you suggesting that there's a statute of limitations for me to demand the money in my savings account from a bank where I have it deposited?
I see your question. I understand your question. Maybe I misspoke, and I would say it was treated at the interest was paid as if it was a regular savings account. So the interest earned was as if it was a savings account. So mechanically, the bank would start, instead of paying the 9% interest on state interest certificate, after 6 months it pays whatever the regular savings rate was. It could have been 3%. So to say he had an account, yes, he had an account. Is it in the same sense as a passbook account? Maybe not. But it was just, it was a change in the interest rate to a savings rate from the certificate rate. That's the way I would explain it to the court. I think this is unique. I think the statute of limitations is certainly a question of law. And it just seemed like the facts of this case, if you look at the evidence, the only thing we really have here of the evidence of the obligation was the last communication of evidence of the obligation was, in fact, that certificate. And so that's why we pled the statute of limitations. And that's why we're doing that across the field.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Crump. Mr. Funk. Not Mr. Crump. Mr. Funk of Durrett and Crump.
I'm sorry?
It's your turn. Go right ahead.
Okay, I don't care.
I want to address a couple of issues. This idea that Judge did qualify Mr. Santelli for a period of 2007 going forward. And I did make a second motion at trial to qualify Mr. Santelli for a limited period of time. And that was on page 271 of the joint appendix. And I think that if you read the succeeding pages going through page 284 of the joint appendix, you will see the court continue to ask questions of me and of counsel for BB&T. But what you see is the same thing we were discussing earlier, that the judge is collapsing the methodology and the foundation in with the qualification ruling. Because at no point does the judge then allow the parties to question Mr. Santelli on his foundation. At no time does the judge say, okay, counsel, argue the standards for foundation. That never happens. And so the judge makes a ruling on my pending motion It's my second motion, and that's on 284. And there's only one motion pending, and that is to qualify Mr. Santelli for a limited period of time. Yes, he went into things about the foundation, but that was improper for him to do. He used an improper standard. And Mr. Perot cited the Hyundai case. That is the case where you first make a ruling on qualification, then you get to foundation. Mr. Santelli didn't investigate every possible factor. It's true. If there were a terrorist attack tomorrow in this country, the Fed might adjust interest rates to deal with the potential impact on the economy. He could not comprehend. He couldn't comprehend that. Every potential factor does not need to be addressed. I'm sorry. Yes, just
no, no.
One last question I want to ask you. Your time has expired, but it was an issue that was raised while the appellee was being examined. It seems to me that the BB&T has stated that this certificate of deposit became a savings account by the terms of the instrument.
Yes.
What do you say about that?
Well, the certificate, I think, speaks for itself. It converts to a regular savings account and earns interest payable thereon.
Well, why are we talking about statute of limitations for certificates of deposit then?
Because I think at the and again we and I think both parties agreed that at a point in time this was a certificate of deposit, and that the original nature of the instrument should govern the statute of limitations. And I think that both parties have stipulated in the pleadings, and the court took it as such, and no one disrupted the court's opinion, that the 118.1, which governs has the three prongs, is what governs the statute of limitations. I mean, looking back, I understand your position, and maybe that was the wrong position to take at the time.
Well, I don't get to take positions until we get upstairs and talk about this case. It's just a question.
I understand.
And it puzzles me how we appear to be discussing an issue that is not the real issue in the case. And I just want to make sure that I know what your position is before you sit down.
I believe it did convert to a regular savings account, because I think that's what the term and the certificate is in the joint appendix.
So let me make it easier. What you're saying is that may or may not be so, but because of the agreements made between the parties, it is the law of the case?
Yes, I believe it is the law of the case, that the governing statute is the one cited.
Well, Mr. Cook, you know, there are a lot of lawyers that would have done a two-step on that question and said, no, we didn't agree to that. And I admire your candor. Thank you.
Thank you.
And your time has expired. Call the next case.